This is Audible.
Books on Tape presents How to Talk to a Liberal, If You Must, The World According to Ann Coulter, by Ann Coulter, read by Elizabeth White, with the first chapter read by the author. Chapter 1. How to Talk to a Liberal.
Historically, the best way to convert liberals is to have them move out of their parents' home, get a job, and start paying taxes. But if this doesn't work, you might have to actually argue with a liberal. This is not for the faint of heart. It's important to remember that when arguing with liberals, you are always within inches of the Arab street. Liberals traffic in shouting and demagogy. In a public setting, they will work themselves into a dervish-like trance and start incanting inanities. Bush lied, kids died, racist, fascist, fire Rumsfeld, Halliburton. Fortunately, the street performers usually punch themselves out and are taken back to their parents' house. Also resembling the Arab street, liberals are chock-full of conspiracy theories. They invoke weird personal obsessions like a conversational deus ex machina to trump all facts. You think you're talking about the war in Iraq, and suddenly you start getting a disquisition on Nixon, oil, the neoconservatives, Vietnam. Tom Hayden discusses gang violence in Los Angeles as it relates to Vietnam, or whether Bill O'Reilly's former show, Inside Edition, won the Peabody or the Pinochle Award. This is because liberals, as opposed to sentient creatures, have a finite number of memorized talking points, which they periodically try to shoehorn into unrelated events, such as when Nancy Pelosi opposed the first Gulf War in 1991 on the grounds that it would cause environmental damage in Kuwait. Oddly enough, about half of liberal conspiracy theories involve the Jews, so be prepared for that. A major impediment to arguing with liberals is they refuse to argue. Liberals' idea of a battle of wits is to say Bush lied in front of adoring college audiences and be wildly applauded for their courage. They're like hack road comics who coax a cheap round of applause out of audiences by declaring, "I just quit smoking," or "My wife just had a baby." Without a Roman Colosseum-style audience to give them standing ovations for every idiotic utterance, you get the liberal disappearing act. At a loss, whenever anyone argues back, liberals have a number of stratagems to prevent conservatives from talking. They shout conservatives down, unplug reporters' microphones, edit conservatives' answers in pre-taped TV shows to make the conservative look like a monkey, burn student newspapers, and heckle conservative speakers. When John Stossel went to Brown University for a report on date rape, he was mobbed by angry protesters chanting, "Rape is not TV hype," and then his microphone cord was unplugged by an angry student. College dropout Michael Moore put a microphone in Republican Congressman Mark Kennedy's face and asked for his help in getting more members of Congress to send their own family members to fight the war on terror. Kennedy replied that he would love to and that he already had two nephews in the military, one on his way to Afghanistan. Moore's documentary shows Kennedy's image but cuts his answer from the film. There is probably no conservative newspaper in the country that has not been trashed or burned by liberals. Meanwhile, there is no known instance of college Republicans burning or trashing liberal student newspapers. To the contrary, conservatives get a kick out of watching liberals try to thrash their way to a coherent argument. Bush lied, kids died. In fact, if it weren't for conservatives with a taste for schadenfreude, literally no one would be listening to Air America, assuming it's still on the air by the time this book hits the stores. Life was much better for liberals when there were only three TV stations airing precious little news. Back in the pre-cable news days, public political debate consisted exclusively of liberal Democrats debating radical Democrats. Now that conservatives are physically present on cable news, liberals are terrified they might have to respond to a conservative point. So liberals filibuster and interrupt, hoping to never hear it. Turn on your TV right now and you'll see a liberal, probably Julian Epstein, trying to filibuster his way out of having to respond to a conservative. If you can somehow force a liberal into a point-counterpoint argument, his retorts will bear no relation to what you said, unless you were, in fact, talking about your looks, your age, your weight, your personal obsessions, or whether you are a fascist. In the famous liberal two-step, they leap from one idiotic point to the next so you can never nail them. It's like arguing with someone with attention deficit disorder. Inasmuch as liberals can only win arguments when no one is allowed to argue back, they enjoy creating fictional worlds in movies and on TV where liberals finally get to win. Remember the Andy Hardy movies? Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland would be headed for disaster until Andy shouted out, "I tell you what, let's put on a play." With liberals, it's, "We're losing on the facts, let's make a movie." In movies, liberals are invariably morally and intellectually superior. They are also good-looking, witty, compassionate, and always right. Basically, Bob Burr, Jerry Nadler, Al Franken, and Hillary Clinton rolled into one adorable bunch. Only in Hollywood is Robert Redford considered a dead ringer for Bob Woodward, Emma Thompson for Hillary Clinton, Dustin Hoffman for Carl Bernstein, and Andy Garcia for Al Franken. Typically, Republicans are played by hard-boiled B-list types whose only other roles are as cruel high school football coaches or rogue army drill instructors. Reflect on the fact that Anthony Hopkins played both Nixon and Hannibal Lecter. The only policemen in the universe who are not aware that cop-killer bullets have never killed a cop are the ones on Law & Order. Only in liberal fantasy movies like Coming Home is a patriotic hawk the impotent klutz who shoots himself in the foot, and the liberal dove the sexually potent one. Only in Hollywood could a sitcom that parodies a U.S. president and is titled There's My Bush be a movie about George Bush rather than Bill Clinton. The show was unceremoniously and quietly canceled because of low ratings. In movies, we always learn that there is no reason ever to fight a war. Unless the Earth is invaded by aliens from outer space with huge scary spaceships and death rays, and men of all races and nationalities can unite against a common enemy, like an Independence Day. So if the Earth is ever invaded by hostile aliens from outer space, you won't have to ask liberals twice to take up arms in defense of planet Earth. It was inevitable, given what liberals value, that on the popular sitcom Friends, beautiful actresses would be depicted hyperventilating over George Stephanopoulos's fictional manhood when he drops his fictional towel. Only in the bizarro world of Hollywood can such a harmless little chap as George exude massive sexual potency. On HGTV, the female host of What Not to Wear leeringly jokes about seeing Bill Clinton in a Speedo. In real life, Monica Lewinsky can be heard on tape describing Clinton's executive branch thus. Think of a thumb. No wonder liberals prefer the world of make-believe. In addition to all Oliver Stone movies and all Michael Moore documentaries, Oliver Stone without the talent, an extremely abbreviated list of liberal fantasy movies includes The Day After Tomorrow, not to be confused with Next Friday, starring Ice Cube. Message, liberals are right about global warming. The hyper-silly disaster epic is based on a book co-authored by UFO, Black Helicopter, The CIA is Beaming Microwaves into My Teeth Fillings Guru, and late-night AM radio maven Art Bell. The Cider House Rules. Message, liberals are right about abortion. Kindly small-town abortionist Michael Caine just wants to help unwed pregnant girls. Disaster strikes when it turns out the young lad taking over Caine's practice, Toby Maguire, is opposed to abortion because it's wrong. The lad soon learns the error of his ways after a black teenage girl from a family of apple pickers is raped and impregnated by her own father and needs an abortion. You can't remind people too often that most women having abortions were raped by their own fathers. This film was a veritable ode to moral relativism and the hideous notion that there are no rules save the ones we make up ourselves as we go along. Shockingly, it only won a single Oscar. The American President. Message. Democrats will vote their consciences even when it hurts them politically, and all Republicans ever do is call people names. In this movie, Michael Douglas plays Bill Clinton as Clinton would like to be. Handsome, thin, courageous, liberal, and widowed. The president's top Republican adversary goes on national TV and calls the president's girlfriend a whore. So it's a plausible story. Dave. Message. Liberals are right about federal spending on the homeless. Only the president can put an end to homelessness, and he's got to cut $500 million in pork from the discretionary budget to do so. He finds the money by poring over the entire federal budget, during an all-nighter, with the help of his tax guy, played by Charles Grodin. Of course, to do that, the president would need a line-item veto. Now, which party do you suppose supports a line-item veto, and which opposes it? Of the dozens and dozens of nonfiction books to come out about the Clinton presidency, only one was made into a movie, The Hunting of the President, by fanatical Clinton apologists Joe Connison and Gene Lyons. Message, liberals were right about Clinton, even if there are only two liberals left defending him. The intriguing plot line is this. A lot of mean people tried to bring down a great president. Leaving aside which account most closely resembles the truth, which of these sounds like a better movie plot? Movie plot A. Through the freak accident of a third-party candidacy, a lying horn dog Jimmy Swaggart type somehow ends up as president of the United States. As his Eva Perón-style wife tries to socialize all industry, the president gallivants with Hollywood starlets, has repeated affairs, accepts illegal campaign donations from foreign enemies, and uses the vast powers of the federal government to frighten and intimidate the people who get in his way. Some end up dead, some have their secret FBI files pored over by a former bar bouncer, some are audited by the IRS. He is finally brought down when he ejaculates on an intern's dress and lies about it under oath, and it turns out the intern has kept the dress. Movie plot B. For no reason whatsoever, a few oddball private citizens develop a deep personal antipathy for a third-way, moderate Democratic president. Amazingly, Hollywood actually made a movie, Bob Roberts, in which the slick cosmetic tricks of the sophisticated right-wing political machine hoodwinked the American people. So that's why liberals are losing all the arguments in real life. Since cable news has begun forcing liberals to confront opposing points of view in real life, rather than movie scripts where the Republicans' only argument is to call the president's girlfriend a whore, liberals have been trying to drop emotionalism as their main argument. Their new posture is mock hard-headed realism. Now they begin sentences with phrases like, "the fact of the matter is," or "experts say," followed by comically false assertions. Liberals flex their spindly little muscles and announce that everything that used to make them cry, gun ownership, racial profiling, missile defense, school vouchers, torturing terror suspects, simply doesn't work. The fact is, it doesn't work, and this is according to several studies, and no, you can't see them, why would you ask? After 19 nearly identical-looking Muslim men hijacked 4 airplanes and murdered 3,000 Americans, people weren't in much of a mood for liberal preachiness about racial profiling. So instead of crying and trying to make Americans feel guilty, liberals pretended to be hard-headed realists. Asked if there was anything wrong with ethnic profiling at airports after 9/11, Harvard Law professor Alan Dershowitz said, "Yes, it doesn't work." Other better ideas, he said, were face recognition technology and national ID cards. These would work great if only we knew who the terrorists were. But if we knew who the terrorists were, the only plane they'd be boarding would be headed to Guantanamo, and we wouldn't need to search anyone at all. On CNN, Juliet Kayyem, from the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, assured viewers that no one is disagreeing with extra scrutiny for potential terrorists. But profiling, she said, won't work. It wouldn't work, allegedly, because Al-Qaeda exists in places from Algeria to Zimbabwe. True, but since we're in America, wouldn't it be a big help if we could screen out most of the Americans? Liberals think "it doesn't work" has such a nice ring to it that the patent absurdity of what they're saying should not detract from their argument. After Senator Teddy Kennedy tried to block federal funding for the government's program to fingerprint and photograph people entering the country from 25 Muslim nations, his sleazy backdoor maneuver was defended on Fox News Channel's O'Reilly Factor by Sarah El Tantawi of the objective, nonpartisan, well-groomed Muslim Public Affairs Council. El Tantawi said it was a huge mischaracterization to think she was going to complain about racial profiling. "That's not the argument I'm here to make." To the contrary, her objection, and Kennedy's objection, was that fingerprinting immigrants from terrorist-producing countries is, quote, "completely inefficient." And we all know how Teddy Kennedy cannot abide inefficiency. Elizabeth Rinskoff Parker, former legal counsel to the CIA, the National Security Agency, and the State Department, has been quoted as saying, "We don't use torture because it doesn't work." And it only took a little arm-twisting to get her to say that. Torturing randomly chosen people on the off chance that they might be up to something, as was routinely done in liberals' favorite country, the USSR, clearly doesn't work. Torturing the guy you know for a fact is withholding information actually works quite well. There may be good and sufficient moral reasons for not torturing people for information, but efficacy is not among them. After decades of womanly crying about guns, liberals admitted their earlier hysteria had been much ado about nothing. The real problem with guns was they don't make people any safer. Fox News Channel's Alan Combs said to Larry Pratt of Gun Owners of America, "Let's talk about some cold hard facts, Larry. The fact of the matter is, Larry," there's that fact of the matter qualifier I promised you, "that the odds that a home will be the scene of a homicide are much greater if there's a gun in the home." Soccer moms across America shot straight up and said, "I did not know that." The study behind this flagrantly dishonest cold hard fact assumed that anyone killed by a gun in the vicinity of a home where anyone owned a gun was killed by a gun in the home. The specious study merely attests to the fact that people who live in high-crime neighborhoods tend to own guns. As the inestimable economist John Lott says, on that theory of causation, hospitals must cause people to die because lots of people die after being admitted to a hospital. It's as if liberals held focus groups on how to best present their ridiculous ideas and were told, "Passion you've got. But what respondents say you lack is intellection, thinking things through, understanding elementary human nature, and a basic awareness of what people are like." If conservatives have not yet persuaded liberals to give up on socialism and treason, we've at least gotten them to fake linear thinking. Liberals' other new hobby is to call people liars. After years of defending Clinton, they love the piquant irony of calling Bush a liar. Bush said he was a reformer with results. Liar. For 50 years, liberals have called Republicans every name in the book. Idiots, fascists, anti-Semites, racists, crooks, constitution shredders, and masterminds of Salvadoran death squads. Only recently have they added the epithet liar. Even noted ethicist Al Franken has switched from calling conservatives big fat idiots to calling them liars. This is virgin territory for Democrats. They never before viewed lying as a negative. Their last president, Bill Clinton, was called an unusually good liar by a senator in his own party, and their last vice president, Al Gore, couldn't say pass the salt without claiming to have invented salt. Having only recently discovered the intriguing new concept of lies, the Democrats are having a jolly old time calling Bush a liar. But they can't quite grasp the concept of a lie as connoting something that is intentionally untrue, or untrue at all. About the time Baghdad was erupting in celebrations after receiving the news that Uday and Qusay were dead, liberals were still hopping mad that in January 2003, President Bush had uttered the indisputably true fact that British intelligence believed Saddam Hussein had tried to acquire uranium from Africa. That was, and still is, believed by British intelligence. It also was, and still is, the conclusion of our own national intelligence estimate. The CIA, however, discounts this piece of intelligence. The CIA did such a bang-up job predicting 9/11, the Democrats have decided to put all their faith in it. They believe the nation must not act until absolutely every agency and every American is convinced we are about to be nuked. Would that they had such strict standards for worrying about nuclear power plants at home. Sharing a chummy laugh about Republicans on Meet the Press, NBC's Tim Russert asked Senator Joe Biden what the Republicans would have done if a Democratic president had uttered 16 mistaken words about national security in the State of the Union speech. Senator Biden said, "This is going to be counterintuitive for Biden to show his Irish instinct to restrain myself. You know the answer, I know the answer, the whole world knows the answer. They would have ripped his skin off." At least Bush put it in his own words, if you know what I mean. Perhaps Biden is annoyed that Bush merely cited the head of the British Labour Party rather than plagiarized him. Back to Russert's challenge, I shall dispense with Clinton's most renowned lies. Every Democrat commits adultery and lies about it. Fine, they've convinced me. Clinton also lied every time he said, "God bless America," and I don't recall any Republican ever ripping his skin off about that. But how about a lie in a major national speech slandering your own country? In Clinton's acceptance speech at the 1996 Democratic National Convention, he said, "We still have too many Americans who give in to their fears of those who are different from them. Not so long ago, swastikas were painted on the doors of some African-American members of our special forces at Fort Bragg. Folks, for those of you who don't know what they do, the special forces are just what the name says. They are special forces. If I walk off this stage tonight and call them on the telephone and tell them to go halfway around the world and risk their lives for you, and be there by tomorrow at noon, they will do it. They do not deserve to have swastikas on their doors." Clinton was referring to an alleged act of racism in which the prime suspect was one of the alleged victims, a black soldier known for filing repeated complaints of racism. The fact that the leading suspect in an apparently racist incident was himself black had already been widely reported in the press. The soldier, not a member of the special forces, by the way, was later discharged. And yet Clinton lied about the swastika episode in speech after speech, including his speech at the Democratic National Convention, publicly citing a phony hate crime in order to accuse white special forces members of racism. And he used a lot more than 16 words to do it. Democrats didn't mind a president telling lies in order to defame his own country. They reserve their outrage for a president who defames the name of an honorable statesman like Saddam Hussein. Note to the Democrats, just because you defended Bill Clinton doesn't mean you have to defend every government official credibly accused of rape. How dare Bush suggest that Saddam was seeking uranium from Africa on the flimsy evidence of the findings of British intelligence, the findings of our own national intelligence estimate, the fact that Israel blew up Saddam's last nuclear reactor in 1981, and the fact that we learned about Saddam's reconstitution of his nuke program only in 1996 when his son-in-law briefly defected to Jordan. The Mr. Magoos from the UN Weapons Inspection Team had missed this fact while scouring the country for 5 years after Gulf War I. Apparently it's okay to get the facts wrong, but only in the service of slandering America, the country we're supposed to believe liberals love. Most of this book will explain how to argue with liberals by example, not exegesis. But there are some useful pointers. Here are 10 simple rules to keep in mind. First, don't surrender out of the gate. This is a highly controversial approach among Republican politicians, obviously. Otherwise, we wouldn't already have a bipartisan consensus for the proposition that you should send half of what you earn to the government. Liberals always want to shame Republicans into making core concessions before the debate begins. You raise taxes, and then we'll discuss cutting spending. You admit the war in Iraq was a failure, and then we'll argue about how to get out of it. You give us abortion on demand, then we'll discuss parental notification. Never has any good come out of surrendering before negotiations begin. Second, unless you were in the Ku Klux Klan, like Vanity Fair's Profiles in Courage winner, Senator Bob Byrd, or you killed a woman, like Senator Ted Kennedy, or you are credibly accused of rape by Juanita Broderick on NBC News within weeks of being impeached, like you-know-who, you don't need to be defensive. Come to think of it, since our side does not accept Klansmen, murderers, or rapists, this rule may be simplified to, don't be defensive. Third, you must outrage the enemy. If the liberal you're arguing with doesn't become speechless with sputtering, impotent rage, you're not doing it right. People don't get angry when lies are told about them. They get angry when the truth is told about them. If you are not being called outrageous by liberals, you're not being outrageous enough. Start with the maximum assertion about liberals and then push the envelope, because, as we know, their evil is incalculable. They stand for the godless rule of dictators. They apologize for abortion, adultery, and everything bestial in society. They support Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, as they once supported Stalin and Mao. They put Stalin apologist Paul Robeson on a stamp. Robeson is David Duke in blackface. This Stalin Peace Prize winner turned his back on Jewish refuseniks in the Soviet Union. After Joseph Stalin's death, he wrote a tribute to the dictator titled, "To You, Beloved Comrade." Most unforgivable of all, liberals have extended the public career of Martin Sheen by at least a full decade. The latest fashions dictated from European capitals ensure that hating America is haute couture. Gwyneth Paltrow and Madonna, with their European homes, European husbands, and European accents, are demonstrating the same unblinking devotion to America's enemies that we have seen in the past. Interestingly, the fake British accent Madonna uses in real life is better than the one Paltrow uses in her movies. This crowd is always in search of approval from people who want to harm America. Nothing too extreme can be said about liberals because it's all true. That's why I almost called this book, "You Don't Know the Half of It." Fourth, never apologize, at least not for what liberals want you to apologize for. These are the people who think Linda Tripp should apologize to the nation, but Bill Clinton was a hapless victim. After Dick Clark had the audacity to apologize to the McWidows on behalf of the U.S. government, liberals started demanding President Bush apologize for 9/11, too. Suddenly, public apologies had become trendy, the thing to do, like getting drunk and having unprotected public sex with Colin Farrell. Instead of fighting the war on terrorism, liberals would prefer a cabinet-level department of closure to handle issues like presidential apologies, with headquarters in a building shaped like a giant hug and Dr. Phil as Secretary of Closure. Fifth, never compliment a Democrat. Unfortunately, when dealing with liberals, you have to set aside everything your mother told you about giving compliments. Mother is wise about many things, and when you go over to Mrs. Jaworski's house, you should still compliment her on her rose bushes. But that doesn't mean you should ever say anything nice about a Democrat. For one thing, it's such a colossal waste of time racking your brain trying to think up nice things to say to a liberal. "Gee, your head doesn't seem quite as large and misshapen as usual today, Senator Kennedy." But more important, compliments to Democrats are always returned with insults. On any television political roundtable, you will see Republican politicians droning on about what a fine human being some heinous Democrat is and what a pleasure it was to work with him, only to have the heinous Democrat turn around and accuse the Republicans of near complicity in genocide. Consider the first statements out of the mouths of three senators on Larry King Live on May 7, 2004. Senator John Warner, Republican of Virginia. "First, if I may say of my colleagues on the committee, and 24 senators out of the 25 were present at that hearing, I think we comported ourselves individually and collectively as best I've ever seen it in the Senate." Senator John Kyle, Republican of Arizona. "I agree with Senator Warner that the senators comported themselves well for the most part." Senator Tom Harkin, Democrat of Iowa. "Well, Rumsfeld should resign for a couple of reasons." A few days later, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham used about half his allotted time on Meet the Press to make clear he had absolutely no criticisms of the Democrats. "I didn't come here to beat on Senator Kerry or to defend any political position. This is not about Republican and Democratic politics. Let's show the world that Republicans and Democrats may disagree on the policy and the war in Iraq, but we have the ability to make sure those accountable are going to be held accountable. Republicans and Democrats need to come together to prove to the world that our system works." The Democrats on the panel returned the love by accusing President Bush of responsibility for the Abu Ghraib prison abuse and saying the mission in Iraq would probably fail. Sixth, never show graciousness toward a Democrat. Rules 5, 6, and 7 may seem similar, but I want to be sure I've covered all the bases. Not only will any kindness not be returned, but it will be used against you. President Bush has repeatedly learned the hard way what happens when you are gracious with Democrats. After it leaked that the dignified staff of the dignified former president had trashed the White House on its way out, Bush downplayed the property damage, saying, "There might have been a prank or two, maybe somebody put a cartoon on the wall, but that's okay." If you happen to know anyone moving into the Bush White House who had seen the damage firsthand, you knew it was a lot more than a prank or two. But instead of stopping while they were ahead, pocketing Bush's graciousness and moving on, the Democrats aggressively attacked other Republicans for having falsely impugned the honor of the Clinton White House staff, citing Bush's magnanimity as proof that Republicans had lied about the damage. USA Today ran a snippy article titled, "Ex-Clinton Staffers on Vandalism? Got Proof?" Former Clinton press secretary Jake Seward insinuatingly asked why there were no records of the alleged damage, creating the uniquely ironic scenario of a Clinton spokesman demanding proof of a statement's veracity. Washington Post columnist William Raspberry noted the damage was never cataloged and asked, "Can it be because the alleged vandalism never happened either?" And then a year later, the full GAO report came back. The Party of the People had done $15,000 worth of damage to the People's House. And that didn't even include the cost of cleaning and sterilizing the rugs from Clinton's office. Seventh, never flatter a Democrat. When Bush was first elected, he invited Senator Teddy Kennedy to the White House for movie night to watch the hagiographic Kennedy Snooze Fest 13 days. He named a federal building after one of Kennedy's brothers and gushingly praised the other. He brought Kennedy over to discuss education several times. Hell, he did everything but split a bottle of Chivas Regal with the guy, which, come to think of it, might have actually won Kennedy over. Asked about Bush's overtures, the Fredo of the Kennedy family said, "It takes more than good intentions to make a difference." When specifically asked whether he thought Bush was smart, a meaningless concept in the case of college admissions but a hard fact in the case of Republican presidents, Kennedy pointedly said he found Bush only engaging and personable. Yes, there's that trademark Kennedy wit and boyish charm. After Bush named the Department of Justice building after Robert Kennedy, Kerry Kennedy Cuomo displayed the celebrated Kennedy graciousness by viciously attacking the Bush administration at the pre-dedication ceremony. Speaking from the podium to her daughter in the audience, Kennedy Cuomo said, "Kara, if anyone tries to tell you this is the type of justice system your grandpa embraced, you just don't believe it." Oddly enough, she didn't add, "Actually, Kara, grandpa's justice was more like the justice system your great-uncle Teddy turned to after he drowned that girl." This is as we have come to expect from a family of heroin addicts, statutory rapists, convicted and unconvicted female killers, cheaters, bootleggers, and dissolute drunks known as Camelot. Extend an olive branch to the Democrats and they'll smack the living daylights out of you with it, while hugging the tree itself, naturally. Eighth, do not succumb to liberal bribery. Faustian bargains are still not a good deal. Liberals are a seductive group of minxes. They recruit conservatives the way colleges recruit star athletes, deploying celebrity starlets as comfort women. Become a liberal and you'll be lavished with great wealth and adulation. Nationally renowned liberal female journalists have been known to offer oral sex to elected officials just for keeping abortion on demand legal. Liberals have scores of money laundering schemes to pay off anyone who attacks a conservative. Foundation jobs, radio stations, websites, movie options, university professorships, and jobs writing for the New York Times. Lots of goodies are available to any conservative willing to give up all his principles. Imagine Satan's temptation of Daniel Webster if the old beastmaster had been able to dangle a development deal with TriStar, one of those phony Harvard PhDs, or even a power lunch with Harvey Weinstein in front of Mr. Webster. Go with liberals and they will give you a lifetime of wine, women, and song. The more public and respected a conservative you are, the more goodies will be offered to you, starting with the cover of the New York Times Magazine. Even a halfwit can get a pretty good life out of liberal enticements, rather like a bureaucrat in the old Soviet Union. If a conservative giant like Rush Limbaugh or Sean Hannity ever became a liberal, there would be parades down Fifth Avenue. At the freshman liberal induction ceremony, Bill Moyers would MC, Bono would sing an original song, Maya Angelou would recite a poem, and Sean Penn would throw out the first punch. Apparently, it's difficult for some people to resist that kind of bribery. Weak and frightened conservatives crave liberal approval and will do anything to get it. The telltale sign is how quickly a conservative will publicly attack another conservative. These masters of the featherweight insight especially enjoy deploring evangelical Christians. To do it right, every time you denounce a devout Christian or Jew for being a superstitious, intolerant ignoramus, you must praise radical Islam as a religion of peace. It should have set off warning bells when David Brock, professional reformed conservative, was committed to the psychiatric ward of Sibley Memorial Hospital in Washington, D.C. It's never a good sign when you have to wipe the spittle from your champion's mouth before he goes on TV, as Ed Asner's handlers are discovering even as we speak. But Brock was a former conservative attacking conservatives. So before long, liberals were dragging him out of the quiet room at Sibley so they could give him $2 million to start a liberal website. You cannot starve in America as a liberal. For $2 million, liberals now have a website exposing the shocking fact that conservative opinion columnists have opinions that are conservative. I could have told them that for, say, $100,000. Ninth, prepare for your deepest, darkest secrets to become liberal talking points. Liberals' idea of a good retort to a conservative argument is to investigate your personal life and find out if you're into S&M. So if you have anything to hide, say, if you were married to a gay guy, but he was really, really rich and you knew you could talk him into running for the Senate, you'd best become a liberal. All will be forgiven. In fact, something to hide is often considered a resume enhancer if you're a Democrat. Just ask Bill Clinton, Barney Frank, Marion Barry. But if you're a conservative, prepare to have your every foible unveiled as if you were caught raping kittens. Even if you've led a blameless life, liberals invent absurd stories about you. They will say you're afraid of Cheshire cats and ordered nude statues at the Department of Justice covered with drapery. You'll be sneered at for your former line of work, such as Tom DeLay, who is derisively called the Exterminator, because he used to run a massive pesticide company. This is apparently not nearly as classy as having been an ambulance-chasing lawyer. You will simultaneously be described as ugly and accused of being on TV only because you're pretty. You'll be called an anti-Semite and a shill for the Jews. You will be called a homophobe and a faghag. As with their political positions, logical consistency is not liberals' métier. If it gets really ugly, they may even call you a neoconservative, by which liberals mean dirty Jew. Not only will you not be lavished with jobs, money, and celebrity starlets, you will be unemployable, unpublished, and embarrassed. For good measure, magazines will never ever run an attractive picture of you. Finally, after liberals have done everything they can to destroy your career, you will be accused of being a conservative only for career advancement. On the bright side, you know you've arrived when liberals start calling you a fag. Curiously, these proponents of tolerance always choose gay as their most searing epithet. Joe McCarthy, J. Edgar Hoover, Matt Drudge, Starz prosecutors, Linda Tripp's lawyer, Christopher Hitchens, Mel Gibson, all these have been denounced as homosexuals at some point by liberals. The New York Times' Frank Rich, now there's someone who would never be called a homo, outed David Brock when he was still on the right. Rich favorably cited Christopher Hitchens, who himself was called a fag by liberals when he crossed them, for calling Gibson's movie The Passion of the Christ an exercise in sadomasochistic male narcissism. Arguing with liberals instantly becomes a game of gay-baiting musical chairs. We just don't think they should get married. Liberals actually hate homosexuals. Tenth, always be open to liberals in transition. Go all out. Be at least as hospitable to them as Saddam was to al-Zarqawi. As with Al-Qaeda, if you can create second thoughts in just a couple of them, it will be a lot less trouble for the rest of us down the road. Liberals in transition will tend to approach you in hushed tones, repeatedly looking over their shoulders and explaining they have a family to feed. You might not want these guys watching your back in a bar fight, but at least they are trying to be good. People coming out as conservatives for the first time face being ostracized by friends, neighbors, co-workers, even family members. Nurture them and make sure they aren't killed before they can move to the other side. That's when it's most dangerous. When Christopher Hitchens decided not to lie to a congressional aide to protect his friend, Clinton consigliere Sidney Blumenthal, Hitchens was quickly denounced by his former friends as a drunk and a sexual pervert. Imagine the indignity of having a Clinton defender call you a sexual pervert. According to the sworn statements from Hitchens and Hitchens' wife, early in the Monica Lewinsky scandal, before Monica produced the dress, Blumenthal told them that Clinton said Monica Lewinsky was a stalker. But later, when asked by congressional investigators whether he had told anyone that Clinton called Lewinsky a stalker, Blumenthal had said, I didn't mention it to my friends. I certainly never mentioned it to a reporter. Hitchens told the investigators otherwise. For his treachery of declining to perjure himself, Hitchens' erstwhile close friend Alexander Coburn wrote that Hitchens gets a frisson we'd guess to be quasi-sexual in psychological orientation out of the act of tattling or betrayal. The booze has finally got to him. His behavior exhibits all the symptoms of chronic alcoholism. He said Hitchens' statement was probably uttered while a pint of alcohol and gallons of wine were coursing through his bloodstream. Oddest of all, Coburn called Hitchens a terrific fibber. All this for the despicable act of telling the truth. Yes, Coburn and Blumenthal are two of those liberal friends I warned you about earlier. To end on an optimistic note, remember there is some good in everyone. Hitler didn't smoke, for example. British traitor and spy Kim Philby had a pet fox. Even among the staunchest members of the Communist Party, there turned out to be a few good ones. Similarly, the vast majority of liberals are not intentionally sabotaging the nation. In fact, I don't think as many as 20% give a damn about the nation. That 20%, of course, deeply hates America. But the majority of liberals are just trying to sell books, get a TV show, be called brave in the New York Times, sound hip, or get a woman's phone number at an afternoon reception at the Westchester Kabbalah Center. Intentions, of course, do not mitigate disastrous outcomes. If your doctor removes the wrong kidney because he was jet-lagged from a Doctors Without Borders flight with actor Noah Wiley, it makes precious little difference to you. This is why my philosophy on arguing with liberals is, tough love, except I don't love them. In most cases, I don't even like them. In other words, my tough love approach is much like the Democrats' middle-class tax cuts. Everything but the last word. I decided to write this book because I have liberals to thank for my career, and I wanted something substantial to throw in their faces. Oops, I mean, I wanted to give something back. The majority of this book will be new to even my most devoted readers, who are able to locate the rare brave newspapers that carry my column. I've included columns too hot to be published until now, along with the editor's rejections. These columns, as well as many columns that caused more than the usual ruckus, like my 9/11 Kill Their Leaders column, I preserved in their original form so you can see what the fuss was about. Even the unretouched columns are my unretouched columns, as they live on my computer, which was not always the same as the published version. I've occasionally run into editors with heavy hands, and I didn't necessarily care for their edits. These are bootlegs, never-released columns, NC-17 versions, lost classics, remixes, extended play versions, and the director's cut. There are many advantages to plumbing my old columns for a Coulterpalooza. For one thing, I'm one of the most unpublished writers in America, except for my books, which sell pretty well. But unless you are on the internet or a subscriber to Human Events, which everyone should read, all but a few intrepid newspaper editors have withheld these columns from you. Also, I have an ad hoc group of fanatical researchers doing fact-checking for me immediately after my columns go up on the internet. If I get someone's middle initial wrong, it will be widely publicized on hundreds of reasonable, calm, objective, nonpartisan websites with names like www.IHateAnnCoulterWithAHotHotHate.com. This is in addition to my fabulous official editor, Greg Melvin at Universal Press Syndicate, who does not consider it a lie to opine that taxes are too high. Also, when you write for a small circulation newspaper like Human Events, your columns are apparently considered community property by other journalists, who shamelessly poach your work without the briefest little credit. At least I know who's been reading my stuff. Now you can read the originals. Finally, I like my columns. Unlike liberals who would rather have their old columns defending Ho Chi Minh just go away, I would prefer that my columns be read more widely. This includes columns from over a decade ago and columns deemed unpublishable. In fact, especially the columns deemed unpublishable.
Chapter 2. This is War. Want to make liberals angry? Defend the United States. Below are my columns on the war on terrorism. It's interesting to review how the carping from the treason lobby has evolved during the course of the war. My position hasn't changed since the column I wrote the night of 9/11. For reasons I cannot understand, I'm often asked if I still think we should invade their countries, kill their leaders, and convert them to Christianity. The answer is, now more than ever. How 9/11 happened. We don't need a commission to find out how 9/11 happened. The truth is in the timeline. President Carter, Democrat. In 1979, President Jimmy Carter allowed the Shah of Iran to be deposed by a mob of Islamic fanatics. A few months later, Muslims stormed the U.S. embassy in Iran and took American embassy staff hostage. Carter retaliated by canceling Iranian visas. He eventually ordered a disastrous and humiliating rescue attempt, crashing helicopters in the desert. President Reagan, Republican. The day of Reagan's inauguration, the hostages were released. In 1982, the U.S. embassy in Beirut was bombed by Muslim extremists. President Reagan sent U.S. Marines to Beirut. In 1983, the U.S. Marine barracks in Beirut were blown up by Muslim extremists. Reagan said the United States would not surrender, but Democrats in Congress threw a hissy fit, drafting a resolution demanding that our troops be withdrawn. All seven Democratic presidential candidates called for our troops to be withdrawn. Reagan caved in to Democrat caterwauling in an election year and withdrew our troops, bombing Syrian-controlled areas on the way out. Democrats complained about that, too. In 1985, an Italian cruise ship, the Achille Lauro, was seized and a 69-year-old American was shot and thrown overboard by Muslim extremists. Reagan ordered a heart-stopping mission to capture the hijackers after the Allies promised them safe passage. The daring plan to intercept the hijackers' flight was conceived by Oliver North, later crucified by Democrats over Iran-Contra, and executed by Admiral Frank Kelso, later savaged by Representative Patricia Schroeder for saying hello to his boys at Tailhook. Kelso's boys captured the hijackers and turned them over to the Italians, who then released them to safe harbor in Iraq. On April 5, 1986, a West Berlin discotheque frequented by U.S. servicemen was bombed by Muslim extremists from the Libyan embassy in East Berlin, killing an American. 10 days later, Reagan bombed Libya, despite our dear ally France refusing the use of their airspace. Americans bombed Gaddafi's residence, killing his daughter, and dropped a bomb on the French embassy by mistake. Reagan also stoked a long, bloody war between heinous regimes in Iran and Iraq. All this was while winning a final victory over Soviet totalitarianism. President Bush won, moderate Republican. In December 1988, a passenger jet, Pan Am Flight 103, was bombed over Lockerbie, Scotland, by Muslim extremists. President-elect George Bush claimed he would continue Reagan's policy of retaliating against terrorism, but did not. Without Reagan to ginner up, even Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher went wobbly, saying there would be no revenge for the bombing. In 1990, Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. In early 1991, Bush went to war with Iraq the way liberals like, with approval from the UN and the Allies. Still, a majority of Democrats opposed the war. Democrats demanded that our troops stop at Baghdad, but then, after 9/11, absurdly complained that Bush didn't finish off the job with Saddam. President Bill Clinton, Democrat. In February 1993, the World Trade Center was bombed by Muslim fanatics, killing five people and injuring hundreds. Clinton did nothing. In October 1993, 18 American troops were killed in a savage firefight in Somalia. The corpse of one American was dragged through the streets of Mogadishu as the Somalian hordes cheered. Clinton responded by ordering our troops home. Osama bin Laden later told ABC News, "The youth realized more than before that the American soldier was a paper tiger and after a few blows ran in defeat." In November 1995, five Americans were killed and 30 wounded by a car bomb in Saudi Arabia set by Muslim extremists. Clinton did nothing. In June 1996, a U.S. Air Force housing complex in Saudi Arabia was bombed by Muslim extremists. Clinton did nothing. Months later, Saddam attacked the Kurdish-controlled city of Erbil. Clinton lobbed some bombs into Iraq, hundreds of miles from Saddam's forces. In November 1997, Iraq refused to allow UN weapons inspectors to do their jobs and threatened to shoot down a U.S. U-2 spy plane. Clinton did nothing. In February 1998, Clinton threatened to bomb Iraq, but called it off when the United Nations said no. On August 7, 1998, U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania were bombed by Muslim extremists. Clinton did nothing. On August 20th, Monica Lewinsky appeared for the second time to testify before the grand jury. Clinton responded by bombing Afghanistan and Sudan, severely damaging a camel and an aspirin factory. On December 16th, the House of Representatives prepared to impeach Clinton the next day. Clinton retaliated by ordering major airstrikes against Iraq, described by the New York Times as by far the largest military action in Iraq since the end of the Gulf War in 1991. The only time Clinton decided to go to war with anyone in the vicinity of Muslim fanatics was in 1999, when Clinton attacked Serbians who were fighting Muslim fanatics. In October 2000, our warship, the USS Cole, was attacked by Muslim extremists. Clinton did nothing. President George Bush, Republican. Bush came into office telling his national security adviser, Condoleezza Rice, he was tired of swatting flies. He wanted to eliminate al-Qaeda. On September 11, 2001, after Bush had been in office for 7 months, 3,000 Americans were murdered in a savage terrorist attack on U.S. soil by Muslim extremists. Since then, Bush has won wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, captured Saddam Hussein, probably killed and certainly immobilized Osama bin Laden, destroyed al-Qaeda's base, and begun to create the only functioning democracy in the Middle East other than Israel. Democrats opposed it all, except their phony support for war with Afghanistan, which they immediately complained about and said would be a Vietnam quagmire. Now they claim to be outraged that in the months before 9/11, Bush did not do everything Democrats opposed doing after 9/11. What a surprise. This is War, September 12, 2001. Barbara Olson kept her cool. In the hysteria and terror of hijackers herding passengers to the rear of the plane, she retrieved her cell phone and called her husband Ted, the Solicitor General of the United States. She informed him that he had better call the FBI. The plane had been hijacked. According to reports, Barbara was still on the phone with Ted when her plane plunged in a fiery explosion directly into the Pentagon. Barbara risked having her neck slit to warn the country of a terrorist attack. She was a patriot to the very end. This is not to engage in the media's typical hallucinatory overstatement about anyone who is the victim of a horrible tragedy. The furtive cell phone call was an act of incredible daring and panache. If it were not, we'd be hearing reports of hundreds more cell phone calls. Even people who swear to hate cell phones carry them for commercial air travel. The last time I saw Barbara in person was about 3 weeks ago. She generously praised one of my recent columns and told me I had really found my niche. Ted, she said, had taken to reading my columns aloud to her over breakfast. I mentioned that to say three things about Barbara. First, she was really nice. A lot of people on TV seem nice, but aren't. And some who don't seem nice are. But Barbara was always her charming, graceful, ebullient self. Nice is an amazingly rare quality among writers. In the opinion business, bitter, jealous hatred is the norm. Barbara had reason to be secure. Second, it was actually easy to imagine Ted reading political columns aloud to Barbara at the breakfast table. Theirs was a relationship that could only be cheaply imitated by Bill and Hillary, the latter being a subject of Barbara's appropriately biting bestseller, Hell to Pay. Hillary claimed preposterously in a Talk magazine interview that she discussed policy with Bill while cutting his grapefruit in the morning. But when asked about Monica Lewinsky, Hillary kept insisting she was waiting for the facts to come out. Couldn't she have asked her husband about the facts while cutting his grapefruit? Ted and Barbara really did talk politics, and really did have breakfast together. It's Ted and Barbara, just like it's Fred and Ginger and George and Gracie. They were so perfect together, so obvious, that their friends were as happy as they were on their wedding day. This is more than the death of a great person and patriotic American. It's a human amputation. Third, since Barbara's compliment, I'd been writing my columns for Ted and Barbara. I'm always writing to someone in my head. Now I don't know who to write to. Ted and Barbara were a good muse. Apart from hearing that this beautiful life has been extinguished from the world, only one other news flash broke beyond the numbingly omnipresent horror of the entire day. That evening, CNN reported that bombs were dropping in Afghanistan, and then updated the report to say they weren't our bombs. They should have been ours. I wanted them to be ours. This is no time to be precious about locating the exact individuals directly involved in this particular terrorist attack. Those responsible include anyone anywhere in the world who smiled in response to the annihilation of patriots like Barbara Olson. We don't need long investigations of the forensic evidence to determine with scientific accuracy the person or persons who ordered this specific attack. We don't need an international coalition. We don't need a study on terrorism. We certainly didn't need a congressional resolution condemning the attack this week. The nation has been invaded by a fanatical, murderous cult, and we welcome them. We are so good and so pure we would never engage in discriminatory racial or religious profiling. People who want our country destroyed live here, work for our airlines, and are submitted to the exact same airport shakedown as a lumberman from Idaho. This would be like having the Wehrmacht immigrate to America and work for our airlines during World War II, except the Wehrmacht was not so bloodthirsty. All of our lives don't need to change, as they keep prattling on TV. Every single time there is a terrorist attack or a plane crashes because of pilot error, Americans allow their rights to be contracted for no purpose whatsoever. The airport kabuki theater of magnetometers, asinine questions about whether passengers packed their own bags, and the hostile lumpen mesomorphs ripping open our luggage somehow allowed over a dozen armed hijackers to board four American planes almost simultaneously on Bloody Tuesday. Did those fabulous security procedures stop a single hijacker anywhere in America that day? Airports scrupulously apply the same laughably ineffective airport harassment to Susie Chapstick as to Muslim hijackers. It is preposterous to assume every passenger is a potential crazed homicidal maniac. We know who the homicidal maniacs are. They are the ones cheering and dancing right now. We should invade their countries, kill their leaders, and convert them to Christianity. We weren't punctilious about locating and punishing only Hitler and his top officers. We carpet-bombed German cities. We killed civilians. That's war. And this is war. The Hun is at the gate. November 29th, 2001. This week's winner for best comedy line about the war is New York Democratic Senator Charles Schumer, referring to, well, it doesn't really matter what he was referring to, but it was military tribunals. Schumer said, "To come up with the best way to do this, Congress ought to be involved." Congress came up with the Internal Revenue Code, right? And the Department of Education? Midnight basketball? The now bankrupt Social Security Trust Fund? The entire welfare state? Yes, that's just what we need. Congress involved in emergency national security measures. Democrats are channeling their frustration with America's imminent military victory in Afghanistan into hysterical opposition to reasonable national security measures at home. Incidentally, the war in Afghanistan ought to prove once and for all what a bunch of paper tigers the Russians were. What were they doing over there for 10 years? It hasn't taken us 10 weeks. Under the strange delusion that their input is necessary during wartime, various congressmen are trying to haul Attorney General Ashcroft before them to answer questions about the detentions of suspected terrorists. Fortunately, Congress has no role in prosecuting this war, either abroad or domestically. They are relieved of duty, free to get back to normal, as the president has recommended, which in their case means enacting massive spending bills to fund comically useless government programs. That should make them happy. Senator Patrick Leahy, Democrat of Vermont, chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, has blustered that there has been no formal declaration of war, and, in the meantime, our civilian courts remain open and available to try suspected terrorists. He said it was questionable whether the president can lawfully authorize the use of military commissions to try persons arrested here. Though I am sublimely confident that the public will recognize Leahy for the sputtering fool that he is, I note that we are at war. We have been at war since 8:48 a.m. Tuesday, September 11, 2001. After a massive attack on our nation, we do not need to wait for some precise talismanic formulation by Congress to inform us of the fact that we are at war. Wars can exist even if Congress does not declare them. If, for example, thousands of American civilians are slaughtered in a surprise attack on U.S. soil. On the off chance anyone didn't know that we were at war when we were attacked, Bush said so in his address to a joint session of Congress the week after the attack. On September the 11th, enemies of freedom committed an act of war against our country. A formal declaration of war has certain consequences only under international law, which is not relevant to domestic security measures taken under the president's war powers. And that's making the rather large assumption that it is ever relevant at all. International law is like Santa Claus. The only difference is that Santa Claus exists only in the imaginations of small children, whereas international law exists in the imaginations of law school professors. In the real world, international law is whatever the United States and Great Britain say it is. Because we are at war, Bush, the commander-in-chief, had authority on September 11th to give orders to shoot down a civilian plane, and he had authority to bomb Afghanistan. He didn't need congressional approval for those actions any more than he needs congressional approval right now to try suspected belligerents on U.S. soil in military tribunals. If Congress doesn't like it, the Constitution gives it two choices. It can cut off funding or it can impeach the president. Knock yourselves out, fellas. Has anyone else noticed there have been no polls taken on the issue of military tribunals for terrorists? This is the most heavily polled populace in the history of the universe. Whenever certain polls are not being taken, you should smell a big fat commie rat. In 1942, 6 months after Pearl Harbor, the Supreme Court upheld the use of military tribunals for 8 German spies captured on U.S. soil, 2 of whom were U.S. citizens. In that case, ex parte querum, the court found that military tribunals were appropriate for suspected enemies who have entered or after entry remained in our territory without uniform, intending to engage in an act of belligerency against the United States. And consider that the Huns were accused only of planning attacks on war materials, not on U.S. citizens. The Supreme Court decided Quirin in less than 24 hours. 3 days later, the military tribunal found the saboteurs guilty. 5 days after that, 6 of the 8 were executed, including Herbert Hans Haupt, a U.S. citizen. Only the 2 who ratted out the plot were given prison sentences instead of death. The fact that the courts are open, the phrase absurdly invoked by Senator Leahy, refers to the Supreme Court's decision in Ex parte Milligan, a Civil War-era case. The Milligan court said a citizen could not be tried in a military tribunal where the courts are open and their process unobstructed, i.e., in the absence of martial law. But the crucial part of the court's decision was its determination that Milligan was a non-belligerent. As the Supreme Court would explain nearly a century later in Quirin, the court in Milligan concluded that Milligan, not being a part of or associated with the armed forces of the enemy, was a non-belligerent, not subject to the law of war. Milligan had not committed any act of war. He was being tried in a military tribunal only because of Abraham Lincoln's suspension of habeas corpus during the Civil War. It was irrelevant to the court's decision that Milligan was also a citizen. We know citizens can be tried in military tribunals, otherwise Haupt, Nazi spy, cum American citizen, would not have been tried and executed by the military. The difference in the two cases is based on the law to be applied, not on the citizenship status of the defendants. Quirin and company were enemy belligerents and thus tried under military law. Milligan was not an enemy belligerent and thus was to be tried under civilian law as long as the courts are open. Michael Moore may wish for Americans to die every bit as much as Jose Padilla does, but he has not conspired, plotted, or committed acts of war sufficient to make him an enemy belligerent. Mere treason is tried in civilian courts. Though Bush has ordered military tribunals only for non-citizens thus far, the Quirin Court did not exempt citizens from military tribunals. Far from it. If unlawful belligerency is the offense, the court held, then U.S. citizenship provides no shelter. Citizens who associate with the enemy, taking its aid, guidance, or direction, are enemy belligerents. When Ashcroft is forced to waste his time in Senate hearings this week, taking him away from protecting the nation from more terrorist attacks, he should remind the committee that there's no exemption for senators either. Attack France, December 20th, 2001. As pundits mull whether America's next target in the war on terrorism should be Iraq or a smaller quarry first, such as Sudan or Somalia, it's time to consider another petri dish of ferocious anti-American hatred and terrorist activity. The Bush doctrine is, we are at war not only with the terrorists, but also with those who harbor them. We've got to attack France. Having exhausted itself in a spirited fight with the Nazis in the last war, France cannot work up the energy to oppose terrorism. For decades now, France has nurtured, coddled, and funded Islamic terrorists. Moreover, the great Satan is getting a little sick of our McDonald's franchises being attacked on behalf of notoriously inefficient French dairy farmers. At the 1972 Olympics, Muslim terrorists assassinated 11 Israeli athletes and one German policeman. 5 years later, acting on intelligence from Israeli secret police, French counter-espionage agents arrested the reputed mastermind of the massacre, Abu Daoud. Both Israel and West Germany sought the extradition of Daoud. Afraid of upsetting Muslim terrorists, France refused on technical grounds and set him free. In 1986, Libyan agents of Muammar Gaddafi planted a bomb in a West Berlin discotheque, killing an American serviceman and a Turkish woman. Hundreds more were injured. President Reagan ordered airstrikes against Libyan military targets, including Gaddafi's living quarters. Quaking in the face of this show of manly force, France denied America the use of its airspace. As a consequence, American pilots were required to begin their missions from air bases in Britain. When the pilots finally made it to Tripoli, tired from the long flights and showing a puckish sense of humor, they bombed the French embassy by mistake. Oops. Butterfingers. France has repeatedly decried economic sanctions against Iraq and has accused the United Nations of manufacturing evidence against Saddam Hussein. The UN, not even the great Satan. The French UN ambassador dismissed aerial photographs of Iraqi military trucks fleeing inspection sites just before UN weapons inspectors arrived as, I quote, perhaps a trucker's picnic. Along with the rest of the European Union, France sends millions of dollars to the Palestinian Authority every year. Sucking up to the PA has really paid dividends to the craven butterbellies. While visiting Arafat in Gaza last year to announce several million more dollars in aid, Prime Minister Lionel Jospin was attacked by angry, stone-throwing Palestinian students. Earlier this year, France connived with human rights champions China and Cuba to toss the United States off the UN Human Rights Commission. Sudan took America's place, and if its diplomats are not too bogged down with human torture and slave trading, they are very much looking forward to attending the meetings. This summer, Paris made Mumia Abu-Jamal an honorary citizen of Paris. In America's cowboy, bloodlust, rush-to-judgment approach to the death penalty, this convicted Philadelphia cop killer has been sitting on death row, giving radio interviews and college commencement addresses for 20 years. Luckily, Mumia sounds like a Muslim name, so Parisians can keep using the same bumper stickers for the war on terrorism. 2 weeks into America's war in Afghanistan, Le Figaro began calling for American restraint. In polls, 47% of the French said they believed the U.S. military action was failing, and only 17% thought it was working, which was, admittedly, 17% more than on the New York Times editorial page. Flaunting France's well-established reputation as a fearsome fighting machine, the French foreign minister, Hubert Védrine, immediately called on the United States to stop bombing Afghanistan. The first indictment to come out of the September 11th attacks was of a French national, Zacharias Moussaoui. He is believed to be the intended 20th hijacker on Bloody Tuesday. France quickly moved to extend consular protection for Moussaoui. Intriguingly, French Justice Minister Maralise Lebranchu has demanded that Moussaoui not be executed. Mademoiselle Lebranchu seems to have forgotten, but we are the great Satan. We also have Moussaoui. It's annoying enough when these celebrated Nazi slayers refuse to extradite terrorists on the grounds that America does not observe the pristine judicial formalities of their pals, China, Cuba, and Sudan. But under what zany theory of international law does France think it can tell us what to do with a terrorist we caught right here on U.S. soil? The great Satan is wearying of this reverse hegemony, in which little pipsqueak nations try to impose their little pipsqueak values